Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi there, and welcome to the Stock Club podcast. I'm James, and with me this week is my Wall Street co-founder and chief investor, Emmett Savage, and our head analyst, Rory Caron. In this episode, we're talking about the market's surprising rebound over the past few weeks, companies that have benefited from the COVID-19 pandemic, and the things we look for when we're picking a stock for the My Wall Street shortlist. Okay, guys, so I want to start off this week's podcast by talking about probably the biggest news of the past 2 weeks, which is Tiger King on Netflix. Rory, have you watched it yet?
Yeah, I did. And you know what? Like, it's 7 hours of my life I'm never getting back.
Really?
It's actually not that interesting. Like, it's a bunch of people who are clearly crazy. Just like tigers. Nothing actually happens during the 7 hours that you watch it. To be honest,
I would say an awful lot happens in the 7 hours.
Well, like, what is the big reveal at the end? Like, you know, the only reason I actually watched it was I was worried I was going to miss out on the meme culture.
Emmett, have you watched Tiger King?
No, it was pitched me the other night, and I had a look at the trailer that Netflix presented. I was like, nah, I can't invest 7 hours. Despite being locked at home and having nothing to do, I chose nothing over Tiger Kings. Oh, what's it called? Tiger Kings, is it?
Tiger King, yeah, singular.
There is a scene at the very end in the last episode where this guy's like driving a convertible souped up sports car thing with like flames on the side of it, and there happens to be like a skeleton sitting in the passenger seat. You don't even think twice about it, because the show has led you to this point where nothing is too crazy. So you're like, of course he's got a skeleton sitting in this passenger seat. Why wouldn't he?
I think it's the perfect show for kind of what's going on around the world at the moment. It kind of sums up 2020 already. So let's move on to more relevant things then. So this week, what felt like the longest March in history finally ended. And with it went the worst quarter for the stock market since 1987. So over the last 3 months, the Dow Jones lost a total of 23%, thanks to growing fears about the COVID-19 pandemic, while the S&P 500 lost about 20% and the Nasdaq lost just over 15%. Since our last podcast, however, the Dow Jones has actually risen more than 12%, while S&P and the Nasdaq have both up about 7%. So this kind of strangely means that the Dow Jones is actually back in bull market territory, which means that the pretty severe drop we experienced across February and March might now go down as the shortest bear market we've ever experienced. And I'm going to come to you first. Investors often talk about like finding the bottom and investing then. Have we just experienced the bottom of this volatility if things are going back up now?
Well, it's the old crystal ball thing. I have one, but it's just not magic. And I wish I knew, because I found last week to be a very distressing week to watch the market, because there was no rhyme or reason to the movements. You know, a giant, supernormal stimulus package was announced, and rightfully the market responded in the way that I'm sure the designers of the $2+ trillion package wanted. But I found it very uncomfortable viewing, because you know, we humankind doesn't really know the very long term story for coronavirus. So did we see a bottom? Have we experienced the bottom? You know, it's really anyone's guess, but my guess is no, we haven't, because more news. So the news of stimulus packages is more or less out there, but the full story of coronavirus has not fully unfurled just yet. And if you sit and watch Bloomberg television, or CNBC or any of the business channels for a while, you know, you'll get every shade of opinion under the sun. But there are quite some compelling pieces out there to say that the worst is yet to come. Now, I don't want to be, you know, all doomsday about it. So I don't believe we've seen the bottom. I'm kind of in watch mode at the moment. I'd rather miss the bottom and be certain that things are on their way up again than to call a false bottom and see that the recent surge was in fact just a response to a data point, which is like, for example, the stimulus or the jobless data or the unemployment data. So I'm of the mind that we will see the market fall more, but I reserve the right to be wrong.
Okay, Rory, what do you think? Is this a what they call a dead cat bounce?
I don't know, and I don't really care. Does that make sense? Like, it doesn't matter if this is the bottom, really. I mean, this is all unfurled over the last, 3 weeks? I mean, like, in February, we were at an all-time high. Now we're seeing, you know, like, every single day now is either up 5% or down 5%. That's super normal. That's not how markets usually behave. And we're going to see at some point things start to level out where we get a couple of days where, you know, the market's up 0.5% or down 0.5%. That's when we know we can start relaxing, because that's when people have fully digested the alarmism and the worst and best case scenarios and gone back to, you know what, most of the time companies are going to grow their profits about 10% a year. Okay. And therefore, every 7 or 8 years, they're going to double. They're going to double in size. That's just how the markets work. This is a temporary shock to the system. We don't know how long it's going to last or what the long-term impact's going to be. I suspect, and I wrote a piece yesterday about there's going to be a couple of companies that will not be around this time next year. But maybe they shouldn't be around. You know, like there's an awful lot of things that just are there because they've always been there.
Yeah.
Every now and again, a forest fire might need to clear out some of the deadwood.
Entirely.
Okay.
And the dot-com bubble was the most perfect example of that in my life, where it was just a giant spring clean. It was the survival of the fittest. And those that emerged in the year 2002, shall we say, were fit for the game. They were ready for the next chapter. And I completely agree with what you said, Rory, like occasionally a forest fire is required.
The pessimists the most pessimistic viewpoint is that there's actually a systematic failure here, that we didn't see, you know, that QE or low interest rates were causing this massive bubble in terms of in stock price equity. And they could be right about that. That's absolutely like a genuine concern. But markets are by their nature always pushing the limits. That's what they do. You know, if you're not going far enough, you're not really in a free market economy. We're always testing the next point of breakage, but we recover, we figure it out, and we start going again. That's the way things go.
So to go down to maybe a more granular level then, so one of the biggest industries that's been impacted by this pandemic has been the dining sector, obviously enough, because many cafes and restaurants have been forced to close down. However, an offshoot of this has actually become beneficiary, which is the food delivery sector. So the likes of Uber Eats and DoorDash and those companies. Rory, we've spoken before, you know, in simpler times, perhaps, about how these companies, you know, they were loss-making ventures, and it was very hard for any of them to carve out a lead in this industry. But could now, you know, when people can't go to restaurants, could this be, you know, food delivery's big moment?
Under normal circumstances, food delivery is a terrible business to be in. Like, it's just awful. Like, at some point in the last 10 years, we were all sold this lie that it was economically viable for us all to have a personal driver, and that we could literally have whatever we want delivered directly to our door for the cost of a cup of coffee. That actually doesn't work. Like, I mean, it works in the sense of, like, if you're the receiver of it, you're benefiting greatly. But if you're an Uber driver or an Uber Eats driver or a Grubhub driver, you are literally living on the edge of poverty, and certain shareholders are making a lot of money off your misery. Like, that doesn't, that will never survive over the long term. The fact that it's now we are in a global pandemic where people can't leave their homes has actually made food delivery a very viable business. So, I mean, would I invest in it? No, because it's not going to last. This will not maintain.
Yeah.
But look, they bought themselves a bit of time to try and figure it out, I suppose. You know, things will change after this. We won't go back to the exact same way we were.
Yeah. But
are we all going to be staying at home, when a vaccine's created and we're not worrying about COVID-19 anymore? Probably not. I think
no.
It's restaurants hate it. They don't make nearly as much money off as they do from serving in-house or even by just having like a pick-up delivery system.
Yeah.
It overruns their kitchens. And, you know, what's Travis Kalanick is sorting out this kind of cloud kitchen business where you have dedicated kitchens that only do food delivery. That's way more viable than your local restaurant serving people at home rather than sending out food delivery.
Yeah. So that's the food delivery sector. And then another kind of, you know, we could talk about the obvious, not winners, but beneficiaries of this kind of situation, like Zoom and Slack and Microsoft Teams and things like that. But kind of one of the more surprising ones has been big tech. So, you know, the likes of Amazon, Facebook, Google have all been kind of, in some of the things I've been reading, applauded for their actions recently, you know, including, you know, Facebook has been praised for its fact-checking about the spread of COVID-19, which is a surprising thing to read about Facebook. Amazon, I know they're experiencing some worker unrest, but they've been also praised in some parts for keeping essential supply chains open and kind of prioritizing what they consider essential supplies. And then even just social networks for in general for keeping us in touch with family and friends. Could kind of this situation and however long it lasts, you know, redeem or repair the reputation of big tech in some way? What do you think, Emmett?
Yeah, I think it's an extension of the point Roy made earlier about a forest fire or a great big clear out. So virtuous behavior will bubble to the top. And I mean, at the moment, there's a lot of unexpected positives from this outbreak.
Yeah.
Like, for example, the US CDC released data that shows that as a result of everybody staying at home, there are far, far fewer road deaths, deaths from influenza, deaths by gunfire. In fact, weekly deaths on the whole have fallen off a cliff edge. And Rory shared that data with us there during the week. And we can probably link it in our notes. I mean, there's been a measured reduction in the world already in greenhouse gas emissions. There's a decrease in carbon monoxide levels caused by cars. And even videos have emerged online showing dolphins swimming in an empty port in Sardinia and in Venice, which is usually packed with boats. And you know, to get to your point and to your question, James, you know, a colleague of my wife said, and she lives in Manila, she's from the Philippines, said that she and her colleagues firmly believe that the world is undergoing a period of healing. And I just love that message. I mean, obviously the backdrop is not good, but there's a great big cleanse happening, I certainly think and hope. And then when you think of big tech's reputation, I mean, when you talk about benefits, that's the best. You know, like, so really, I think these businesses have the platform and the ability to do good without a lot of effort. And when they do it, the world notices. And I think, you know, big tech's bad rap came through, I suppose, a sequence of events that were not designed to be bad, or at least perceived as bad. But now we have the inverse happening. So I think we're going to see the giant platforms of the world using their reach to do good. And yeah, great. This cleansing behavior is washing through at the moment. And whether it's Apple, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, they will do good because they know they have the power to do it. And there's a sponsoring thought there, which is our reputation will improve.
Rory, or do you think it might be a case that it's just after behaving so badly in past times, I'm thinking particularly of Facebook, is that it's kind of a bit of a surprise to see them doing the right thing?
I wouldn't say it's a surprise, but it's, I mean, like, I kind of shudder at the idea that they're being praised for this now. Like, you know, as if, you know, they should have been doing this all along. Like, you know, this idea that we needed something of this magnitude to happen for them to get their shit together is upsetting. You know, they should have been fact-checking things and not letting people... Like, the idea that you have to now say you can't post misinformation about COVID-19 because it could potentially lead to deaths, that is, you know, people have been posting misinformation about so many things over the years that would lead to deaths. It's just that now the spotlight is on them, that they actually have to, like, make action on it. So, I mean, look, it's the forest fire again. Sometimes you need something big and dramatic for people to realize how messed up things are.
Yeah. I think a massive part of it as well is that it's so big in that it's affecting the entire world. It's not just, you know, with Facebook, my mind was cast back to the midterm elections where they got in a lot of trouble for not fact checking political ads. And, you know, it was obviously a massive thing, but it's, you know, it's just, that was just in the US in certain parts. Whereas this, you know, COVID-19 pandemic is affecting every country in the entire world. And it's, you know, it's an earthquaking event. Like there's nothing, definitely in my lifetime anyway, that's ever been like this. And it's kind of, if they can't kind of behave good and do the right thing now, when can they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's like, you know, the alcoholic who has to get liver cancer to realize that he's needs to stop drinking, you know, like if you keep pushing things to this level, you're going to see a backlash. And this, yeah, like, you know, maybe the US should think about publicly funded elections and they don't have to worry about this anymore. You know, these are the kind of things that do suddenly emerge from giant crises.
Yeah. Okay. We'll leave it at that then. I've never heard that metaphor before, Rory, about the alcoholic.
We've all, you realize you have to lose weight when you look at a picture of yourself and realize I'm disgusting.
Especially after all 3 months of sitting at home. So there's loads of great stuff to check out in my Wall Street app at the moment. The team has written some great daily insights this week, including a guide on how to analyze corporate management and the likelihood of companies like Airbnb having their IPO this year. We'll also be adding our new Stock of the Month report to My Wall Street on Monday, April 6th. And the new episode of the Stock of the Month podcast will follow on shortly after that. All of these things, plus loads more, are available exclusively to My Wall Street subscribers. So make sure to go into My Wall Street right now and check those out. Emmett, we're going to move on to the company we never talked about. You were talking about Pure Storage this week.
I am. And as you know, this is a company where we generally descend to playing rock, paper, scissors in order to decide who's going to dive into the latest results.
Yeah, this is a perfect Peter Lynch boring company, I think.
It is, yeah. Well, I actually asked, you know, for the shortest straw this week, and I am making this broadcast of my own free will. Neither I nor any of my loved ones have been threatened by any of the other analysts in my Wall Street. So I wanted to do this because Pure Storage was one of those, I suppose, partial enigmas from our shortlist of great stocks. And I suppose Top Line Don't Read, having dived into the business and reacquainted myself with the moving parts or not moving parts and the geeks of the world laugh, I'm actually very impressed. I think it's a wonderful business. So basically, to rewind, in 2009, traditional hard drives served, you know, the vast, vast majority of the world's data storage needs, like from personal computers through to giant business enterprise class data centers. And, you know, people, the world will know what a traditional hard drive is when you just, if you have a laptop that's more than like 10 minutes old, it wears, it gets hot. You basically hear your computer sucking in air to keep hard drive and a few other components cool. And it's a moving part inside your computer that stores data. And that's, I guess, most people, whether you're techie or not, will relate to the fact that your laptop gets hot because it has to keep something cool. And that's what, you know, what's happening there. But Pure Storage was founded with the intention of selling flash-based solid state storage, SSD, we're going to call it, which is just a technical piece of equipment that allows information to be stored way, way faster and without moving parts. So I think the latest set of Apple laptops or Macs and iMacs all use SSD storage, so there's no spinning parts and it's nice and quiet. And even today, SSD devices are 10 times more expensive than traditional hard drives. When you measure dollars per terabyte. So there is a great advantage to having SSD storage, which is what Pure Storage specializes in. But spinning magnetic disks are slower, more energy intensive, but they're way cheaper. So to explain Pure Storage's business in their own words, and this quote unquote, they say, "The might of our all-flash technology grows competitive advantage so powerful it almost seems unfair, which I think is great. A real
there's a cockiness or something.
There's like a cockiness. It's goosebumps. You're like,
wow. I think they call that a humble brag.
Yeah, oh, it's a very humble. It's we make you so much better. And I guess in a nutshell, Pure Storage has a data platform that enables businesses to enhance their performance and, in their words, reduce complexity and cost. So that's kind of how they describe themselves in their own SEC documents. And one of the points of reassurance for me on Pure Storage from the outset was that our chief product officer, Alesh, it's his favorite stock. He loves it. So, you know, as a barometer, we were like, Alesh, is Pure Storage any good? And he doesn't think it's good. He thinks it's great. So Pure Storage...
As a disclaimer there, he did get himself trapped in Vietnam during a global pandemic. So, you know.
Yeah, he is there at the moment. What city is he in, Rory? Is he in...
I think he's in Dalat at the moment, but the likelihood of him getting home in the next month is very slim.
Oh, so very slim.
So, yeah. Sell Pure Storage.
Yeah, exactly. So Alesh liked it, and he's plenty of time to think about it over there in Vietnam. So so if we just look at Pure Storage from a numbers perspective, in around August 2018, what, 1.5 years ago, a year ago, is about 26, 27 bucks a share. Today, it's about 12 bucks 40 a share, which its market cap is about $3.3 billion. So like everything else, really, Pure Storage has fallen from its all-time highs. You know, on the big picture, it's still on an upward trajectory, but it has had quite a fall from its August 2018 price. The business has loads of cash. There's tons of cash, $1.3 billion in cash. It has about $600 million debt. And has very high insider ownership. I think insider ownership was 10%. And what I believe to be most important, has a very future relevant business. Because in fairness, to give you such a competitive advantage, it just seems unfair. I mean, that's pretty exciting. So the best we can do, I think, in this COVID-ridden world is to look at Pure Storage's Q4 results, which were published and announced way back on February 29th, 2020. So a month ago, they published the state of the nation for the business, and it was a very nice business indeed. So in their Q4 results, they had kind of five highlights from the quarter, which I think are fairly extrapolatable for the entire year. They are consistently, quarter after quarter, growing and taking market share. And I don't think that that's going to change immensely as a result of the crisis we're in at the moment. They are expanding their presence within the public cloud. Their subscription services momentum is gaining pace. They have all types of innovation that they're talking about, and they still say that their data experience is still the most modern and most relevant for businesses. So if we just kind of dive in, so the business is very future relevant. It has plenty of cash to ride out the world we're in at the moment, the crisis we're in at the moment, and it has a total of, so its total number of customers, when you think about it, might seem underwhelming. They have 7,500 customers, which is not a huge number when you think of it, $3.3 billion business. But it has 44% of the Fortune 500 businesses, so it has the brand strength and the product offering to entice 4.5 out of every 10 businesses on the Fortune 500 over to their platform. And I certainly think that they're going to attract more in the years ahead. And their customer account number just really steadily grows for every quarter. It's just like drawing stairs on a piece of paper. It just goes up, 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 up. Every quarter, their customer account grows very regularly, and generally by around 500 customers over the last few quarters. Their revenue is on a run and is up 21% in the last quarter. And they've tons of deferred revenue, which is great. Customer lifetime value is high. Their margins are unbelievable. It's like 70%, 70.5% gross margins. Like every number that Pure Storage has is good or great and improving. But the thing that I think gets me most excited, and it's that qualitative versus quantitative piece that you have to, I suppose, reconcile when you're a stock investor is very much a qualitative point, which is their customers are raving about what they do. Their net promoter score is 86.6, which is like huge. I didn't even realize an NPS score could go so high. I mean, the national average for NPS for all things cloud computers, 24. Which sounds about right, because how excited can you really be? But somehow their 7,500 customers' excitement about the product they're offering, this SSD storage in the cloud, is 86.6. So there's loads of people like Alesh. And Gardner, who published their Magic Quadrant for, you know, since beginning of time, have Pure Storage in the very, very top right hand quadrant for solid state arrays. Wow, what a wonderful thing to boast about. So
what an accolade, yeah.
What an accolade, exactly. So I've become, in the researching of Pure Storage, in reacquainting myself with what they do and why they're different, and looking at their most recent numbers, I think that they're a business that will not get significantly hurt from the coronavirus outbreak. I don't see many of the 7,500 businesses deciding they're going back to old spinning disks for storage or to build their own data center. I think that they have the cash to ride this out, however long it lasts, whether it's 3 months or 13 months or possibly even longer. And I think that the fact is their customers, they're not your average, the decision maker for Pure Storage doesn't look like one of the four of us here on this. I include Luke, but it is Alesh. Alesh understands the finer points, you know, on the decision, and I think it's a really attractive business. And the fact that it's just been hammered down, I've put it into my shortlist of 50 companies at the moment that I'm quite interested in investing in. Okay. in the weeks and months ahead.
So that was Pure Storage, our company we were talking about. I hope you're listening in from Vietnam, Alesh. You got a great shout out there in your recommendation of
you're
that.
You're pushing that as like something that, like, just because Alesh likes something, you like it. Like, I mean, that would actually be a turnoff for me. No, like, I wouldn't want to be a member of any club that would have him.
Right, let's move on before there's a HR incident. Jargon Busters. So, Stephen asks us on Twitter, what screener criteria do we have for the stocks considered on the My Wall Street shortlist? Rory, I'm going to come to you. What are the general things we look for, I suppose, to boil down the 7,000 or so publicly listed companies into a more manageable list that we might consider to add to My Wall Street?
So to start off with, it's probably easier to say the things that we avoid because, you know, there's certain industries that we'd never go near. We don't recommend any pharmaceutical companies. We don't recommend any big banks. We don't recommend any big energy companies. The thought process behind that, and Emma, correct me if I'm wrong, but like there's an expertise level there that you need for those industries that I certainly don't have. And you know, Charlie Munger said, you know, we have to deal in things that are understandable to us. You know, we need to. The starting point has to be, can I understand how this company operates?
Yeah.
So that cuts out a huge amount. You know, you've already killed off 90% of the companies out there when you ask if we can understand what they're doing, because there's just certain things that we don't know. Then you're left with what happens to be a bunch of mostly kind of consumer-facing companies, some B2B companies, some B2B2C companies, and they're more understandable. You can kind of, you know, even if you don't interact with them personally, you probably know someone who does interact with them in some level. And then we look for the things that define a good company, and that's, do they have an economic moat? Is there a reason why this company should exist today, or is there a reason why this company will be here in 10 years and another company won't be just come in and take them over? Do they have good managers? Do they have people that we trust? You know, if you listen to an earnings call, do you feel this person is an honest person with integrity?
Yeah.
that, I mean, that cuts off, you're getting down now, you've cut 7,000 down to quite a small number with just those checkpoints. Mm-hmm. And then it's just kind of, you know, what do you believe in? Do you believe this business is important? Are they going to do something that, or are they doing something that people really care about, are evangelists about? If this company disappeared tomorrow, would people notice? If the answer to that is no, it's probably not a good investment.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Thanks for that, Rory. So Michael asked us via the My Wall Street app, I was wondering if you might be able to talk about asset allocation. Since your focus is on equities, it would be helpful to understand how to allocate all assets across the different asset classes. Emmett, I'll throw that to you.
Yeah, sure. Well, we're the stock guys, as I'm sure our listeners might have noticed. And there's an awful lot of writings and about portfolio theory. And if you start a pension and go into a pension fund manager, they have a formula that they apply on how cash has to be deployed across all the different assets. Because primarily when you go into portfolio theory, wealth preservation is a very big part of that equation. So a portfolio manager will have a portion of their investments distributed across land, property, bonds, stocks, and all the different types of assets that you can deploy cash into. So we haven't necessarily, as a business, taken the broader portfolio view into account. We could Google it as easily as the next guy and figure what, you know, what one should do. But I guess for Michael, the answer is, it starts with what are your supreme objectives? Like we, if cash preservation is king for Michael at this moment, it would make sense to kind of figure out those assets most least likely to lose value. The nice thing about stock investing, well, there are very many nice things about stock investing, but it is the catalyst within your asset portfolio. So you could buy a vast tract of land in the middle of America and know that, you know, by the time I retire, it would be broadly the same value, maybe a bit up, maybe a bit down, but you can boost the value of your long-term returns with stocks well chosen. So I'm not giving a pointed answer to Michael's question or additional answer. How do you like? So that it really comes down to your own, your own objectives.
Yeah, and I definitely don't. You kind of the stage of life you're in and your risk profile.
Yeah, and Emmett, the word objectives there, I think, is like the most important word. You know, like me and my dad were talking about investing right now, and he was kind of like, would you be buying equities at this level? And I was like, yeah, of course. And then he sent me this this email from the wealth manager of Lego, the guy who owns Lego's wealth fund. It's an $18 billion fund, and he wrote this paper saying I wouldn't be investing in equities right now, things are too uncertain.
Like,
there's two types of investors in the world. There's the ones who are trying to get rich, and they're the ones who are trying to stay rich. Mm. If I had $18 billion right now, I wouldn't be buying stocks. Like that, I just wouldn't. I'd be like, why bother? Stay off field at the moment. But this is the time when people who are trying to get rich are going to pick up some serious bargains.
Yeah,
Rory, I'd say there's a lot of things you'd be doing if you had $18 billion right now. So that's the end of Jarring Muscles. Let's move on to the elevator pitch then quickly. So a lot of people suddenly have a lot of free time on their hands at the minute. So what I asked you guys to do this week was pitch me your favorite investing podcast that's not Stock Club. And the disclaimer here is you can't make it too good of a pitch. But is there any other podcasts you listen to that are not Stock Club, but are good for the kind of the common investor? Rory, go with you first.
There's plenty. Going to give a shout out to Jason Moser, whatever podcast he's on, I'm always listening. There's a guy called Scott Galloway who is professor of business in New York University. He's great. If he's on a book called Pivot with Kara Swisher, and I think he's just released his own one, his insights into businesses are brilliant. I listen to him religiously, and you should too.
Big fan of Scott Galloway. He's got a great blog, and his Twitter feed is usually fantastic as well. It kind of keeps you up to date with what's going on. Emmett, what about you?
Yeah, and I'm actually more of a reader than a listener. I think it was David Walliams, the author, said I've written more books than I've read. I might have recorded more podcasts than I've listened to. But yeah, I do like Pivot. I've listened to Pivot podcast on many occasions. I'm a big fan as well. But I'd have to go with Rule Breaker Investing by David Gardner, who has been a mentor to me for a long time. And a guy who has a very, well, he's incredibly strategic in his thinking and can take a very, very mature, far field view of where the world is headed. And on his podcast, at a nice pace, he'll generally pick a stock and just kind of dive into it. And it's all very conversational, understandable. It's a nice podcast. So I'd go with David Gardner's Rule Breaker Investing podcast, which is brought to you by The Motley Fool.
Cool. So they were Pivot by Scott Galloway and Kara Swisher, and then the Rule Breaker podcast, which comes from The Motley Fool. So that's about it from us here today at Stock Club. Don't forget about all the great new stuff in the My Wall Street app at the moment. And if there's anything you want us to discuss or explain on the next episode of Stock Club, make sure to get in touch with us. You can catch us on Twitter, that's at My Wall Street HQ, or email us at pod@mywallstreet.com. That's pod@mywallstreet.com. Don't forget to subscribe to Stock Club too. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please leave a review for us on whatever platform you listen to us on. That's it from us. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Happy investing.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.